Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
So, Steve, did Ava Gardner and Howard Hughes have a good relationship?
Well, they did, until he dislocated her jaw.
What?
Well, don't worry. She hit him back with an ashtray.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
Hello, my name is Matt, host of the Pirate History Podcast. Pirates rank among the most mythologized and romanticized of all historical figures. It can become easy to forget that pirates were real people that had real-world concerns. If you like tales of high seas adventure, derring do, and also want to learn more about who Blackbeard supported to be king, you can learn more about all of that at the Pirate History Podcast.
Hello, this is Eric Rivenis, and welcome to another episode of the Most Notorious Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. I appreciate you continuing to stay subscribed during my summer recess. So, on to the show. I'm pleased to have as my guest today, Paul Hoffman. He's a journalist and an author, and he's here to talk about his book, Murder in Wauwatosa, The Mysterious Death of Buddy Schumacher. Thanks so much for joining me.
Well, thanks for having me, Eric.
You have a personal connection to this story, don't you? Do you mind telling it how you first heard about this murder and what led you to write a book about it?
Sure. Well, I was Wauwatosa is my hometown. It's just outside of Milwaukee. And we moved into Wauwatosa, I think I was about 5 years old. And a couple years later, we had a couple living next door to us, an older couple, and the lady. Oh, you know, I guess today maybe you'd say she had dementia or something. There was something going on there. But so you really weren't ever quite sure exactly, you know, what she was telling you was true or, you know, just where it was all coming from. Well, there were a couple of times where she would see me outside and she'd just kind of walk up to me and say, "The police know what happened to the Schumacher boy." It kind of freaked me out. So I walked away. Then it happened again. She'd say something like, "He was killed down by the river, down by the railroad tracks." And that was all she said to me ever about Schumacher, you know, a death in the Schumacher family. Well, I know my dad had bought the house that I grew up in, the house that I was living at the time, from a Mr. Schumacher. So I figured this was, you know, maybe this lady's talking about some uncle or brother or son or something. I asked my dad if he knew anything about it. He said he had no idea. So it was out of my head for most of the rest of my life up until, you know, about 10 years ago, maybe I started thinking about it a little bit more. It's in the back of my head. Every once in a while, I thought, I wonder, you know, if I could look something up, if, you know, if I could finally find out what Mrs. Harwood said, if there was anything to it. So I was at my parents' house over Christmas break one time, and they still live in the area. I did an internet search and Buddy Schumacher, you know, the murdered boy carried out of his house in a casket. I saw a picture. I was with this cut line. It was just, just unbelievable to me that I actually found something like this. And the first thing I found was a casket being carried out of his house. And it said murdered boy. And I was like, okay, well, that's going to lead me to some more questions. And so I had more questions. And, you know, what happened? And just it sort of snowballed after that. It was something that had been in my head off and on for 30 some years, and it was just I needed to answer the questions, and that's kind of how the thought into going into, you know, actually starting the book came about.
You lived in the same house that the Schumacher family lived in, right?
Buddy died in 1925, and 2 years later, the family moved into that house, which is still there. It's 8118 Hillcrest Drive, and the family then owned that house from 1927 till 1969 when my dad bought it, and we moved in, and I, you know, spent my childhood in that house.
So what was Wauwatosa, Wisconsin like in 1925?
Well, it was a lot different than it was in 1969 when I moved in. Today it's a typical suburb. It's right next to Milwaukee, just to the west. And it would be, you know, like a typical suburb, like maybe Greenwood, Indiana, something like that. Back in 1925, though, there was a lot of area between Wauwatosa and Milwaukee that was undeveloped. So it was considered a little bit farther out back then. It was a small town and fairly safe at the time. Although at the time, the standards for mental health care and all sorts of other things were a lot different than they became later. And you had buildings for the mentally ill, not too far away from the little village area of Wauwatosa. And it was pretty accessible for what they called them back then were hobos and tramps, and basically homeless men who would ride the rails. And right going through this middle village area of Wauwatosa, you did have a railroad going from Milwaukee and heading out west. And so you would get a fair amount of men riding on those. This is kind of toward the end of what they call the golden age of riding the rails and things like that. But there were still plenty of them there. And also, along with the railroad tracks, you also had a river. The Menominee River went right kind of parallel the tracks. Now, along the riverbanks back then, you had these tall reeds, a lot of tall reeds, thick reeds that were maybe 6 feet tall. Very easy for homeless men to go in there and build camps and not really be seen. So you can say that it was a pretty safe area, but then I'm sure there were, you know, parents warning their children, hey, watch out, don't go down by the river, don't go by the railroad tracks, you never know who's going to be around, and things like that.
I'd like to ask you about the Schumacher family. How did they find themselves in Wauwatosa? What was the father's occupation? What was their family situation like in 1925?
Right. It was kind of odd because the father's side of the family, Arthur Sr., he came from a fairly poor Lutheran family, you know, with teachers and things like that. Now, he ended up getting into watchmaking and things like that. So he got into a trade, and he ended up marrying Florence Armstrong, whose family was pretty well-to-do for the most part. Her father had been a councilman, basically, in the town of Wauwatosa. She had uncles who ran a hardware store in Milwaukee that was a pretty big hardware store and made a lot of money. So it was a little bit odd pairing for the parents, but it seemed to work out really well. They were married, and she died, I'm trying to remember, it was in the 70s sometime, and another kind of interesting tidbit was that when Mr. Schumacher sold my dad the house in 1969, he went to live at a Lutheran home for the aging in Wauwatosa, and that probably died about 1976 or so, something like that. Well, about 4 years after that, I actually worked at that facility in the maintenance and the housekeeping department.
And there was a sister as well, right?
Yes, sister Jeanette. They called her Nettie, I believe. And she was a little bit older than Buddy. And from all accounts that I could gather, probably treated him pretty much like an older sister would treat a younger brother. And, when he finally did disappear and they found the body, she was devastated because, I think she felt that she hadn't been as nice to her little brother as she should have been. But, you know, it's hard to fault her for anything like that because a lot of kids will tease each other back and forth like that.
You have a lot of pictures of Buddy in your book. He looks like your typical all-American kid. What kind of boy was he?
Well, from what I could tell, and it's difficult now because just about anybody who knew him personally is deceased now. I did run into one lady that I was trying to get to talk to me about it, and she said that, and this is what, 90 years later, she said, you know, it's still too difficult to talk about. And this is, you know, 90 years later, she didn't want to talk about it, but he was a good kid. Liked to hang out with his parents and went with his dad hunting and things like that, helped around the house. And, you know, I did end up getting his report cards from Lincoln Elementary School, which I actually ended up attending myself. But he had fairly decent grades, and, the teacher said he was a good kid and a bright kid and things like that.
Could you walk us through the day of Friday, July 24th, 1925?
Yeah, the morning, Buddy got up in the morning, decided he was going to go hang out with some friends who lived down the street or around the corner. They decided to jump on a freight train and head out to the local fishing hole, which is a little west of, probably about a mile and a half west where they lived, which apparently was a fairly common occurrence. They would, instead of walking all the way there, the freight train would come by and they'd just jump on. Well, apparently when they got to the swimming hole, they jumped off the train, were heading toward the swimming hole, and kind of came upon a man who had a long coat on, sort of ran at them or made them feel uncomfortable in some way, and Buddy's friends took off. They were a little bit older, 2-3 years older, and all we have is their statements at this point that we read in newspapers from the day. And they said that they took off and Buddy didn't. And that's the last anybody who knew Buddy saw him. So what happened was the boys went back home. Nobody said anything. I'm not sure, they're probably a little nervous about, we left this 8-year-old kid out there by himself with this guy who scared us. Maybe we shouldn't say anything. He'll make his way back home. Everything will be fine. And it wasn't fine. The father, when Buddy didn't come home for dinner, the father went to talk to the kids because he knew he hung out with those guys. And the kids told him what had happened. So it started a big investigation, a big search into, what happened to Buddy. And the search lasted actually, for 7 weeks. And the first couple of weeks, there was an intense search all around the area. And the search cooled off after a little bit because nobody was finding anything. So, but the day that, that he disappeared, that's pretty much all we have. Now, his friends did change their mind a little bit later about certain things. So, we're kind of left to sort of read between the lines and try to guess at actually what really happened. I'm pretty sure that what the boys said the first time around probably is the most likely scenario.
How long did it take for the police to be called? I'd imagine pretty quickly, right? Because the boys knew almost immediately.
Yeah, it was either that night or the next morning. I can't remember for sure, but there was a Wauwatosa policeman who lived one or two houses away, and I know he was involved in looking for the boy. And everybody, it seemed, who lived anywhere near, got out and tried to help. They had big troops of Boy Scouts go out and help. But yeah, the police were called really, really soon. I just can't remember if it was that night or the next morning.
There were a lot of interviews with witnesses, and the stories weren't consistent with each other, were they? Which made it more difficult for police.
Yeah, it seemed a lot of people, or at least a few people that I know of, changed their stories of what they saw, And I'm not sure exactly why. You can guess as to the reasons you think, people would change their story. And I mentioned a couple of the reasons people might do that in the book. But I think the investigation took a lot of strange turns, and nobody really knew what was up, partially because people were changing, their minds about what they saw or who they saw Buddy with and things like that.
What were the primary differences in the stories?
Well, the boys, his friends. Now, at first, they only mentioned two boys being with them. And about a day or two later, newspaper reports said there were three. An older brother of one of the other boys, they said, was along. Now, I'm not sure if he really was or not. The boys, after having said, well, we saw this man with Buddy, and the man's name was Edward Vreeland, and he actually was in the Wauwatosa jail or police station for up on a charge of vagrancy at the time that the boys said, yeah, we saw him with our friend. Well, yeah, a couple of weeks later or so, a couple of days later, all of a sudden the boys were like, well, you know, we're really not sure that's the guy. So, what do you believe, what they originally said or what they said later? Did somebody get to him and say, hey, you guys need to change your story. You need to think about something. I'm not sure. We had another situation also involving this Edward Vreeland, who had been hanging around the area, for the past couple of weeks. He went to a lady's house a little bit farther west of the swimming hole, and took out a handkerchief and was wiping his brow with it, and it was fairly dirty, and she was asking him if he needed a drink, if he wanted her to wash the handkerchief, and she noticed there was an A stitched on it, and she noticed exactly how it was stitched, what it looked like. Well, Buddy was killed by a handkerchief shoved down his throat. When they got the handkerchief out, it had an A on it. They had the lady describe the A that she had seen on Edward Vreeland's handkerchief. It matched up almost perfectly with the one they found in Buddy. Well, a couple of days later, all of a sudden this lady wasn't so sure that's really what the handkerchief looked like, and she couldn't be sure. So another case of, I'm not really sure what's going on here.
Yeah, that's really weird. Not to get too far off track, but it's so interesting. In this golden age of hobos riding the rails, people would offer them meals, offer to wash their clothes. But now when people see a transient coming down their back alley, they lock their doors. There was more sympathy for their plight back then, wasn't there?
Yeah. Well, my father-in-law was probably the first person to actually finish reading the book when it was published. And he grew up in the country here in Indiana. And he said back then in those days, and he goes back that far, he said that you had hobos and you had tramps. He said the hobos, they were homeless, but they were okay. He said the tramps weren't. So you had to watch out, and they had distinctions. They also had, and these guys would put the markings next to people's houses, kind of code, maybe in the dirt or something like that. And, would say, somebody will give you a meal here if you ask, or stay away from here, or, something like that. So they kind of had their own system of communicating with each other.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I was also wondering this. Was this case ever reinvestigated? Were these boys who were giving conflicting stories ever questioned later on as adults?
I don't think so. This case was really odd. I think that what happened eventually, and they had to let the first guy go, the guy that they had identified as being with their friend. Once they said, well, we're not sure, and the guy didn't confess anything, and there's no evidence left that they could fingerprint, and the lady changed her mind about the handkerchief, they really didn't have anything to hold the guy on, so they had to let him go. In the meantime, you've got reports all over the state of boys, with men, and people wondering, is this Buddy? And so they'd call, and police would go to, all these different corners of Wisconsin looking, and no, they looked into it. No, that's not Buddy, and all these other things. Well, what happened with the investigation, I think eventually they just wanted it closed. They had, they had nobody to pin this on. Two different guys eventually, one in Ohio and one in Minnesota, confessed to the crime. Obviously, at least one of them could not have possibly have done it, because they were completely separate. They had, no knowledge of each other at all. They decided the guy in Ohio, no, there's no way. He got so many of the facts of the case wrong. There's no way he could have done it. The guy in Minnesota, who had been charged with doing performing a similar crime on a boy up in Minneapolis. He confessed to the crime, and investigators from Wisconsin went up there to talk to him. And at first they said, well, you know what? He's got too many of these facts wrong. You know, there's no way he could have done it. He could have read about it and gotten, you know, some of the information, but there is no way he could have done it. Okay. Well, a day later, they changed their mind. They said, yeah, he did it. I think that they just wanted the crime solved. And I think they said that that guy did it. Edward Brandt was his name. And he did it. It's over. We're done. Although officially now it's still unsolved because I really don't think they thought he did it. I ended up getting Brandt's prison records, which are extremely creepy. And I would not suggest anybody get anybody's prison records from somebody who has committed crimes against children. But I had to read it to find out what he was all about and to find out, you know, if it was possible that he had actually, you know, committed the crime. And I think that once they decided that we have somebody, that was it. I think they just kind of let things go officially. Now, I read later, you know, many years later, an account that said that the Buddy Schumacher crime was officially unsolved. So maybe at some point along the way, they said, you know, they said, well, this William Brandt really didn't do it.
But he was never tried for this crime, right?
No, because he was already in prison for life in Minnesota, and the penalty for that in Wisconsin was the same. So he wouldn't. I mean, he would still would have just been in jail for the rest of his life. So they didn't even bother having a trial.
I read a book a few years ago, and I can't recall the title off the top of my head, but it was written in the 1890s by a wealthy young man who decided to go undercover as a hobo. And he wrote about some pretty terrible things that he witnessed or heard about. And a few of these guys, he wrote, would prey on young boys. They would go into a neighborhood and regale them with tales of the open rails and all of the adventures and freedom they could experience. But in reality, they had their own dark motives. And some of these men were pedophiles looking to enslave boys for their own terrible personal use. But others took these boys under their wings for purely business reasons. I mean, a hobo showing up on a stoop with a young boy had a far higher chance of scoring a really good meal than by himself.
Right. Yeah. You tug at somebody's heartstrings, and you know, it's more likely, and you can do that with a younger boy.
So how did the newspapers cover the disappearance? Did all of the local Milwaukee papers cover it in a similar fashion?
It was a huge story in the Milwaukee papers. The Wauwatosa paper was a weekly paper at the time, and they had a couple of small stories in during the time that they were searching for the body. But you know, the only picture they had was a picture of Buddy, I think the one that's on the cover of the book, in fact. And the Milwaukee papers, boy, we're at the tail end of yellow journalism, what you've got there is a tendency to overblow stories, to err on the side of the underdog to a fault, and to just kind of, you know, make everything more dramatic than it really is, and use language that you know, the common people don't really use. And it was kind of odd to me, you know, having been in journalism for 30 plus years now, and you know, not figuring out how anyone could cover, you know, events like some of these newspapers did. But you had big stories. You had pictures of where the body was found with a white X where the body was found, and little arrows and things like that. You had a picture of Buddy's friends in the Wauwatosa police station with Edward Vreeland sitting no more than maybe 2 feet away from them. And they're pointing at him, you know, saying, this is the guy who our friend was with. We saw him. And I mean, you would never see a picture like that in a newspaper today of, you know, kids sitting next to someone they thought kidnapped and murdered their friend. Just really strange. And some other things that I found out, he had one of the major papers was the morning paper, the Milwaukee Sentinel. And I actually ended up working for them at one point. But the afternoon paper was the Milwaukee Journal. And you would read things in one paper or the other that the very next issue of the other paper would contradict. I had one situation where the morning paper said that Mr. Schumacher was going to dress up like a hobo, go hang out in hobo camps, and see if somebody knew what had happened to his son. Well, the afternoon paper said he had never said he was going to dress up like a hobo. So it's one of those situations where even reading newspaper accounts, you kind of have to look at, what's being said, what's not being said, how they contradict one another, and what the likely facts really are. And sometimes you can't tell what the facts are. You just have to report what had been reported and say, well, this is what they reported. Now, what the real facts are, here are some, ideas for you to think about as you're trying to decide for yourself what you think.
That was a really crazy story. Art Schumacher planning to infiltrate the hobo world. You found no basis for all of that.
The only thing I saw was that one report in a newspaper, and never did he actually do that. And the next report said he wasn't going to even, and he hadn't even thought about doing it. So I don't know where the original report came from, really.
You also wrote that there was a newspaper headline that said, "Fear moron took boy." Is that right?
Right. And that, the term moron means something a little bit different today than it did back in 1925. In 1925, you had the intelligence scale, the IQ scale, and it's separated into various categories. And if your IQ is such and such, you're considered normal. Well, the other, some of the other categories were idiot and moron, and those scientific terms back then aren't exactly taken like scientific terms today. They're just slurs. But back then you would see moron and idiot in the newspapers, and that meant that somebody's IQ was allegedly between whatever numbers they were.
Yeah, there were different levels, including imbecile, I think.
Imbecile was one of them too, right? Yeah.
The police chief was George Baltus, right?
Right.
What kind of police chief was he? Was he competent?
As far as I can tell, he was in office for quite a while. It was difficult to get too much information on him. It was hard. I couldn't track down any descendants of his. From what I could tell, he did a fairly decent job. I do know that after the incident with Buddy, he did declare Wauwatosa a hobo-free zone, basically, for lack of a better term. But I don't know how well that went. I don't know how well it was enforced. But, it was one of the things that they did after this case to try to, make Wauwatosa a better town. And they did do a few things after that. So, while it was an extremely tragic thing that happened to Buddy, for the town, I think it was, an indication that, hey, there could be more trouble and we need to clean up a few things.
So this search, it was incredibly extensive, wasn't it? Virtually the entire community was involved.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I got a hold of one lady who does remember when her parents went out to search for Buddy. And she's probably, I talked about 5 years ago now, so she's probably about 97. But she said she remembered when she was little, and all the neighbors got out of their houses and went to go look for Buddy. And like I said, it was a fairly small village area at the time. The Wauwatosa expanded up to, it's about 50,000 people maybe today. But back then it was a fairly small, tight-knit community. And practically the entire community, I would find anybody of age who, is physically capable, was going out and walking through those reeds along the river, walking along the railroad tracks, looking in just about any place you could possibly think, the area near the swimming hole and everywhere.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, Box of Oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course, you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
Thing done weird things. Cat and Jethro, Box of Oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the Box of Oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
Some of us love history. Others used to or never did because history was presented as nothing but the rote memorization of names, dates, and facts. Basically, the story got left out, and that made history kind of suck. My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a university professor with a PhD in history, and bringing history to life is my passion. That's why I created my podcast, History That Doesn't Suck. I want to teach you everything you need to know about U.S. history, but I do so through stories. Let me tell you about George Washington begging his men not to mutiny against Congress, Clara Barton saving Union soldiers amid enemy fire, enslaved Frederick Douglass risking his life for liberty, and about so many other figures as their real experiences make industrialization, social movements, and even congressional debates and tax policy come to life. Subscribe to History That Doesn't Suck today, and join me, Professor Greg Jackson, every other week for a new episode, where I'd like to tell you a story.
When Johann Rahl received the letter on Christmas Day 1776, he put it away to read later. Maybe he thought it was a season's greeting and wanted to save it for the fireside. But what it actually was a warning, delivered to the Hessian colonel, letting him know that General George Washington was crossing the Delaware and would soon attack his forces. The next day, when Rahl lost the Battle of Trenton and died from two colonial Boxing Day musket balls, the letter was found, unopened, in his vest pocket. As someone with 15,000 unread emails in his inbox, I feel like there's a lesson there. Oh well, this is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Every episode, we look at the bad ideas, mistakes, and accidents that misshaped our world. Find us at constantpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Brenna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore all of the weird little questions and conspiracies of the universe in our new podcast, Mystery of Everything. Everything has an explanation.
We hope.
But that is what we're here to figure out. We will dive into the science behind many popular conspiracy theories, such as vaccines causing autism, flat earth theory, and was the moon landing fake? And if so, why the heck would anyone even do that?
But it's not just conspiracies. There's a lot of cool mysteries that we will attempt to use science to explain, such as near-death experiences, what made the Vikings go berserk, and can I control my co-host with MK Ultra?
Wait, what? Anyway, make sure to check out the Mystery of Everything podcast everywhere where you find your podcasts.
We watch movies now, you know, coming-of-age movies of kids growing up in the early 20th century, you know, playing on the street, in the woods, in this kind of idealized life. But,
right.
I mean, there were these tramps, these transients, often wandering through the woods who would encounter and interact with them, and a few were dangerous. And there is a possibility that it was one of these men who murdered Buddy, but not to get too far ahead here. You mentioned a camp, right, in the woods made by some of these tramps that was found by police.
Well, along the river, they had various little campsites, and you never really knew how many were in one place, really. And they would move, you know, from time to time. They'd go from one to another. But, when they were searching for Buddy, they would come across some of these places. And back then, you had very few people who were 6 feet tall or taller. But most of these men, they're, you know, 5'5", 5'7", 5'9". You would never see them with the, you know, 6 foot tall reeds. And you get into, you know, some of these little campsites and they would just have, you know, maybe like a newspaper and, you know, some food they got somewhere or something like that, and a little campfire perhaps. And, you know, and the time of year this is August and September when they're searching for them. So it's still, you know, pretty warm. And you know, they may not even have campfires for warmth, so you may not see smoke. It was very easy to hide in very thick reeds like that. And they had little trails back there. It was, what's really interesting for me, having grown up there, is going back to my childhood, thinking about when I would hang out along the river and in the same areas, having absolutely no idea, you know, what had happened there in 1925. And I would see some of these paths through, you know, the area, which had been cut down quite a bit, you know, from these tall reeds, but you still have a lot of brush and trees and such. Well, my wife and I were out there, you know, when we were researching the book and we were just kind of getting a feel for where all this happened and things like that. We went back and some kids had built like a lean-to or something, a little campsite with little rocks, like a sidewalk into their you know, kind of like a, almost like a teepee made of brush sort of thing. And it just, it brought back, you know, these feelings from, oh my gosh, you know, remember what we read in the newspapers about these, you know, hobos and being here and having their camps here. So that was, it was kind of a, you know, a moment where your hair kind of stands up on the back of your neck. And we've had a couple of moments in you know, researching the book and afterwards, after we knew what happened and we'd been back to the area, that it just kind of shook us a little bit.
Does the area still look pretty much the same as it did back then?
It's not quite as wild as it was. They've built a road that goes up along the river there, Menominee River Parkway, and they've cleared out a lot of the brush from near the river. The old swimming hole, in about the mid-30s, they eventually got a swimming pool built on that area. And so they had that for a while, and then shortly thereafter, they built a new big swimming pool on the other side of the river, which is where I swam when I was a kid. And my wife and I actually, we went there. Here's another one of the creepy stories that brings the hair on the back of your neck to stand up. But we went into the pool. We were going to go swimming. We go into the new pool. We knew everything that had happened nearby and things like that. So we're in the pool, and all of a sudden, train goes right by the pool there. And so we're just kind of looking at each other like, yep, buddy was on a train like that. A couple minutes later, we're kind of sitting around, and one of the things they do there is, well, little kids will, if the little kids want to go in the deep end of the pool, they've got to take a short little swimming test, and they give them a little password so that when they ask them later, you know, hey, you're in the deep end, what's the password? Well, for the girls, they say, hey, little girl, what's the password? Well, for the boys, they go, hey, buddy. Every single time they say, hey, buddy. So I'm sitting there thinking, Buddy Schumacher, swimming, train, and I've got goosebumps all over my arms and legs because I know what happened really close to there. And it was just the weirdest moment, you know, that I had in a long time.
Wow. So you just said that Buddy was on a train. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, I jumped on a fake freight train, a slow-moving freight train. They would come by because they had a stop in Wauwatosa in the village right across the street, basically, from where Buddy's house was. So they could probably just jump on while it was sitting there. And then when they got to the swimming hole, it couldn't have picked up all that much speed by the time it got to the swimming hole, which, you know, a mile and a half away. If you get a big freight train, it takes a while to get the speed up. So, you know, maybe it's going 10, 15 miles an hour at that point. And then they jump off and they're really close to the swimming hole. So that's, you know, and it sounded from all the reports like this wasn't an uncommon thing, that, you know, kids did this fairly often. And I mean, you know, the homeless guys who were riding the rail did the same thing.
Okay. So it had nothing to do with him being taken on a train.
No, they just decided they wanted to, that was the best route, the best way they could get to the swimming hole that they knew of, the fastest way. So they got on the train by themselves.
So he disappears in July of 1925. August passes, and by the time September rolls around, there's still nothing.
Right.
Do people go on with their lives again? Do things slow down?
Yeah, people didn't know. Right, yeah, because people didn't know where else to look. They, you know, we looked everywhere we could possibly look. You know, if we hear reports from out of state, or if we, you know, maybe the boys were just kidding about, you know, getting off the train. Maybe Buddy stayed on the train. They're afraid to tell somebody. And then maybe it got going too fast and he was afraid to jump off. So maybe he ended up in Madison or Minneapolis or, you know, somewhere out there. But, you know, there were no credible reports ever came from anywhere else, you know, that would link Buddy.
So a clue is found, right? A note on an old piece of oak?
Well, yeah, there were a lot of things that people saw that thought were, you know, well, maybe this is a clue or something. And there were also times when people thought, well, you know, maybe people are putting things out there just to throw people off the trail, too. So there was at one point a you know, what somebody thought was a clue etched on written on a piece of oak. And they went to, you know, look at what it said and everything. And they thought it might have had something to do with Buddy and decided it eventually didn't. And which is where, you know, just about everything dried up. They had found, you know, a boy's clothes out in a wash house on the Milwaukee River, just off the Milwaukee River, and went to check that out. And that turned up, you know, nothing, obviously, because we eventually found the body. So every other clue that came up, you know, turned out to be nothing. I just can't imagine being the family and having all these reports of, well, we might have found your son, you know, such place, and we might have found a clue here, and we might have found a clue there. And, you know, for 7 weeks while the investigation was into, you know, trying just to try to find the boy was going on. You know, how does the family deal with something like that, you know?
Yeah. So his body was found on September 13th. What was the condition of his body? Can you talk about how that discovery was made?
Yeah. Well, there was a guy in Milwaukee who decided he wanted to go mushroom hunting out in Wauwatosa. So he went out there and he was on somebody's farm a little bit west of where the fishing hole was. Why do I keep saying fishing? The swimming hole. I know why, because I went fishing last weekend. That's the problem. And I've got fishing in the brain. So
that's completely okay. I knew what you meant.
Guy in Milwaukee decides to go mushroom hunting out west of the swimming hole on somebody's farm. There's some wooded areas and he's just kind of milling about and he comes across the body. Okay. So he sees canvas shoes. He sees the overalls. The body's not in very good shape. It's kind of mutilated. And so he kind of gets a little freaked out and goes back home, doesn't say anything. He's kind of sitting there, and later on he's talking to his son and says what he saw. And the son says, you know, he really need to talk to the police. And he thought, well, you know, maybe I should. I don't want anybody to, you know, think I had anything to do with it. And, well, he goes, talks to his buddy, and his buddy convinces him, yeah, you gotta tell the police, you know. So they tell the police, they go back out there, they show him where the body was. And so it was kind of under a clump of bushes, but not so hidden that, you know, you wouldn't have thought that all these people who had been all over this area two or three times at least would have found something. So the question remains, well, was the body somewhere else and then placed there later after people stopped looking there? Or was it there all the time and people just happened to be blind when they went by this? You know, it's kind of hard to tell, really.
Could you talk about the coroner's findings after the body was examined?
Yeah, they had decided that the boy had been sexually molested. I'm not sure how they determined that. But they also decided that he had been asphyxiated with a handkerchief shoved down his throat. It cut off his airways. It was so far down his throat that he couldn't breathe. And they recovered the handkerchief. They washed all the clothes and everything. So even if there had been DNA testing then, it wouldn't have done any good. Everything would have been washed. And we've got DNA testing now, but since everything had been washed, it, you know, that wouldn't have worked now. Fingerprinting was in its infancy. I'm not sure if they had the technology in Wauwatosa at the time. If they did, it wouldn't have been of any use because, of course, they washed everything. So That's the coroner report basically, you know, said all that, and to try to solve the crime, it was made more difficult by certain things, the washing of the clothes. And back then that may not have even have, you know, prevented anything. It may not have changed what they could have done, but as time went by, it made it impossible. Evidence also apparently went missing from the DA's office, the clothes, the handkerchief, things like that. Maybe. They had different reports. The DA couldn't find the evidence. He thought it had been locked up in his safe. A couple of days later, they found it sitting underneath something else. At least that's what he said. I have no reason not to believe him, but you've got the first murder committed in your town in, you know, in 30-some-odd years, and it's a child, and everybody and their brother is interested in what's happening, and it's being covered really heavily by the Milwaukee media, and the evidence isn't where it's supposed to be. That's just a little odd. Another thing that comes into play here in trying to solve the crime at this point is that there's no evidence in the Wauwatosa Police Department prior to 1936. Nobody could tell me why that was. I don't know if there had been a fire in 36 or something else. If somebody threw things away just for whatever reason, but there's no evidence prior to 1936. So the 1925 crime, I can't even get the files, that they've been destroyed years ago.
You mentioned a few suspects, Edward Vreeland, Frank Blue, right? And the guy from Minnesota, was he William Brandt?
William Brandt, yes.
Yeah. So I was hoping you could talk a little bit more about each of these guys. What evidence pointed to whom, and what eventually happened to each of them?
Yeah, Frank Blue was an employee with the railroad, and his name just came up once or twice. And, I don't think there was too much to his story. I think they pretty much discounted him pretty much from the beginning. I think it was more questioning, and that's it. So, he really wasn't too much of a major player. But Edward Vreeland, he was the one that Buddy's friends had pegged Buddy with when he disappeared. What I found out about him is he's originally from Illinois, I believe, and was divorced. At some point, got kicked in the head by a horse and wasn't quite all there all the time. He had memory lapses and, he had several different jobs after that. Was working at a bottling plant, I believe, in Milwaukee for a little while, and in a little hotel kind of, a boarding house, basically, for a little while. At some point decided he just didn't feel like working anymore and decided to get out of Milwaukee and, take his chances on the road. Now back then, 1925, you're starting to have the highway system being built too. So there are guys out there hitchhiking, but, those rails were still, one of the major ways they got around. So I'm not sure how he got out to Wauwatosa. It wasn't that far. Maybe 7 miles or so for him to walk. So he could have walked out there. During his time there, he had gotten in trouble for vagrancy and giving kids a hard time. Exactly what a hard time meant in 1925, it's kind of open for debate. And read several accounts, and it could have meant various things. One of the things they tried to do, they talked about trying to inject him with a truth serum. They didn't end up doing that, but that was one of the things they had tried to talk about. He said he had had some blank spots in his memory recently. He didn't know if he could have committed this crime during one of his blank spots or not. He said he didn't remember it. He couldn't say that he did, but he couldn't say that he didn't. They tried to bring some, a pastor in to talk to him and get maybe we can get a confession, maybe he'll have like a come to Jesus kind of moment and confess to the crime. And that never happened. His brother actually came in and said, you can't keep him here. You have no evidence against him in this crime. And the vagrancy, you've already kept them here long enough for that. So I'm gonna you know, start legal proceedings against you if you don't let them go. So once the kids changed their mind, once the lady changed her mind about the handkerchief, there was no evidence. They basically had to let him go. And he went with his brother, and I think his brother was in Iowa, and I sort of lost track of him after that. So I'm not really sure what happened to Edward Breland, really, after he left Wauwatosa. I do know that he left with his brother. Now, William Brandt, he was the guy, he had been in Milwaukee, and I think he had delivered newspapers at one point. At some point, he decided he was going to head off for Minneapolis or St. Paul and lived there. He had family up there and committed a crime against a boy up there, similar, molested him and killed him, and was convicted of that crime and was serving a life in prison when he decided to confess to the Buddy Schumacher killing. Now, I read accounts that he had written while in prison about talks he had with the prison psychologist, and he said that in those accounts that he did not kill Buddy Schumacher, but he said that, well, they wanted somebody to confess. He goes, I was in jail for life anyway. They don't have capital punishment in Wisconsin. I'm not going back there and getting hung. So I, you know, just decided to confess, so I'll be over, which seems pretty likely to me. So especially since when authorities went to go interview him from Wisconsin, their initial reaction was, nah, he didn't do it. Too many of the facts of the case are wrong. So it leads me to believe that he probably did not kill Buddy Schumacher, even though he was in the Milwaukee area around the time that the killing did take place. And then William Brandt, eventually he died in prison, oh, sometime in the 30s, I think. And I believe he's buried at a prison cemetery.
Obviously, it's impossible, of course, to know for sure, but it sounds like Edward Vreeland might have been the guy.
It seems most logical to me that he either did it or he had a hand in doing it. If he was working for somebody or if he was, you know, involved with other people in doing this, I don't know. But it seems to me that he was the last, it's pretty credible that he was the last person seen with Buddy Schumacher. Now, he may have enticed Buddy somewhere, you know, and there were other guys around. Somebody else may have done it. Vreeland may have blacked out. But I'm pretty sure he at least had something to do with it.
As part of your research, were you able to talk to any police officers on that force now? Is this still an open case?
Well, I got a hold of somebody, and he said it's officially an unsolved case. They're not really looking into it. I think if somebody were to bring some evidence that might lead to a conviction, actually not going to convict whoever killed them because they've been dead for a long time, but to actually solve the case, I think they probably would open it up and take a look at that. Everything that I've looked at, I don't think I have anything that they wouldn't have had at some point, you know, throughout the years. You know, nothing new that would, you know, make them think, well, you know, we can actually solve this. We may have some pretty good ideas, but we can't say anything officially. So I think they would. But, you know, I don't think there's a real good likelihood.
Have you had a chance since the book was published to talk to residents of Wauwatosa? What has the reaction been like?
Well, most of the people I've talked to are just amazed that happened, because most people, it's so far back, nobody hardly remembers it. You know, you'd have to be 95, 97, whatever, you know, to remember something like that. Or, you know, there's just not that many people around. But most of the people I know, they said it was just, you know, an absolutely fascinating case. They just couldn't believe that, you know, some of the things that are in the book actually happened. You know, the people around there are like, I know where that was. I know where this is. You talk about this place and, you know, I've been there, and now I go there and I'm creeped out. And,
things like that. And we did, Buddy's buried just north of one of the middle schools there. And I've had people call me and say, hey, I went to go look for his gravestone. Can you give me more detail on how I find it? Things like that. And, the book itself has gotten really, really positive feedback I have. And even from Buddy's family, I've got two of his uncles I got a hold of, and another probably like a great uncle or something. And they said, hey, once they found out that I was working on this book, they said, whatever you want, whatever cooperation we can give you, it's ours. You've got it. Which was fantastic because, the family pictures, I would have never had those. And, the pictures of Buddy when he was little and things like that. And, just some of the insight into the family and things like that were just invaluable. I think it just adds a lot of depth to the book to know so much more about how the family operated and where they came from and things like that.
Did you say his uncles? His uncles were or are still alive?
Yeah, two of his uncles are still alive. He's got he had his older sister Jeanette. She married and she had three boys, two of whom are still alive. One of whom I got a hold of in Australia. He's been a professor at one of the colleges over in Australia for a number of years. And then another guy who had been worked at a museum in Virginia, and he had just retired. So I got a hold of them. And then there was another guy who is still in Milwaukee, who I think was their cousin. And he had actually given me, maybe 50 to 75 photocopies of newspaper articles about the case. He said, anything you want. He goes, this is all the research I've done. And he had research up until Buddy's death. He didn't have anything beyond that. And I thought, well, okay, you have this big case and everything, and it's this huge thing. Something happened afterwards. I mean, the story just doesn't end with the boy dying and them finding the body. So I went into Milwaukee Public Library with a bag full of quarters and did a little bit of microfilm research of my own, filling in a few of the gaps. He missed a few papers along the way, but then starting with after they found the body and had the funeral, what happened after that? What was the aftermath? And that interested me quite a bit, because you had a couple of more child killings and abductions in the area in Milwaukee after that. And, everybody's wondering, well, is that the person who really, killed Buddy Schumacher? And they'd look into it and they'd find out it wasn't. And then you'd have discussions on, well, all these child abductions are happening all of a sudden. What do we do about it? And so there would be big discussions on, how to keep your children safe and how, if you're a stranger, not to be too friendly toward children because they could be enticed maybe not by you, but by somebody else. And what do we do about the mental health problem? We've got all these people out on the west side of Wauwatosa that we have these hospitals for. A lot of them are just kind of allowed to roam free during the day. We're not, maybe they go into town, maybe they go to the swimming hole. That's probably not a good idea. Are we treating these people properly? Because some of them are going to be going back into society. We don't want them going back into society killers like, some other people that they knew of. I read one book when I was researching Edward Vreeland, because he stayed at some sort of home for, kids who had gotten in trouble. Somebody else had been there a couple of years before and ended up being one of the worst mass killers in the, at the end of the 1800s that the country has ever known. So there was a lot of discussion at that time following Buddy's case. What do we do? What is the best way to go about doing these things? Do we put these people in these places and make them stay there for life? Is it possible for them to be rehabilitated? There's just a lot of discussion about that sort of thing back then.
Who is that killer? What, one of the most famous killers?
Oh, I knew you were going to ask me that. What's his name?
Carl Panzeram, possibly?
Yes. Yes. That's it. I was thinking it had a Z in it. It was not coming to me right away. But yeah, he was a pretty nasty man. He had suffered a lot of abuse while he was in, I think it was the Red Wing facility up in Minnesota.
Yep, yep. And, Red Wing Reformatory, yep.
Right. And he said when he got out, he was going to create as much havoc and destroy as many lives as he possibly could, and he did.
And I just wanted to clarify, too. I think you meant to say nephews, not uncles, right?
You're right. Yes. Nephews. Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure.
Yes, his sister's boys would be his nephews. Sorry. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. So where should we direct people who want to learn more about this murder and would like to buy your book?
Right. I've got a website, paulhoffmanauthor.com. I'm also on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter. It's pretty easy to find me there. And you can get the book pretty much anywhere. It is traditionally published by the History Press, and it's my first of two books. So you can go to Amazon. You can go to the History Press website. You can go to your local bookstore. Please, first, go to your local bookstore first.
Absolutely.
If you can't get it there, go online. I always suggest people get it from their local bookstore. You can't get the ebook version from your local bookstore, and it is available on ebook too.
I too always try to get a real copy of a book first, but sometimes an ebook is convenient.
Yeah, and you can still get them directly from me if you go through my website and send me an email. I still have probably about 50 in my basement, so supply is starting to run out finally.
You might even be willing to autograph it, I'll bet.
I've done quite a few of those, so yeah, I've got no problem offering them.
Well, perfect. Thank you for your time.
Well, thank you, Eric. It's been a pleasure.
Again, this has been Paul Hoffman, author of Murder in Wauwatosa, The Mysterious Death of Buddy Schumacher. This has been another episode of the Most Notorious Podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobwebbed corner of the world. I'm Eric Rivenis, and have a safe tomorrow.